Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we'll hear part of last night's talk on native bees and their impact on rare Palouse prairie habitat from entomologist Tim Hatton. But first, this news. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash announced today the Obama administration is proposing lifting most of federal wolf protections for gray wolves across the continental United States. In a release to the Associated Press, Ash said this will end over 40 years of recovery efforts for the wolves, which were hunted to near extinction over the last 100 years. The animal has recovered significantly, but many scientists and lawmakers say the action is premature. With approximately 6,100 wolves living in 10 states in the Northern Rockies and Western Great Lakes, they say now is not the time and want expansion into other states. Historically, wolves lived in almost all areas of the continental United States. Under the administration's proposal, federal protection would only be extended to a small, relatively new population of the Mexican gray wolf subspecies now living in New Mexico and Arizona in the southwestern U.S. desert. Currently, there are a number of wolf packs spread across Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and more recently in Washington and Oregon. Other packs have been sighted in Colorado, Utah, and in the Northeast. Ash said realistically, wolves will not return to the levels of the past several hundred years. He said science is an important part of this decision, but really the key is the policy question of when is a species recovered? Does the wolf have to occupy all the habitat that is available to it in order for it to be recovered? Our answer to that question is no. Some states have already taken matters into their own hands. Hunters and trappers have killed over 1,600 wolves over the past few years in the Northwest, Wyoming, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. That does not include several thousand killed by government wildlife agents. The hunting has eased ranchers' concerns the animals will run rampant on their land, killing their livestock indiscriminately. Ranchers have been complaining their hands have been tied because of restrictions telling them when and which animals can be killed. Supporters of wolves say there is a vast territory unoccupied and ready for wolves to live in. They say areas of California, the Southern Rockies, the Pacific Northwest, and New England are ready for wolves without the worry that they would kill livestock. Carlos Carroll of California's Klamath Center for Conservation Research says expansion can be done and there is enough space for wolves. Carroll thinks wildlife officials have bent to political pressure from politicians who do not want wolves to live in their states. Carroll said they've tried to devise their political position first and then cherry-pick their science to support it. The Center for Biological Diversity has made it clear they will challenge any action the administration might take in lifting the restrictions and or taking the animal off the endangered species list. The proposal will be subject to public comment, and a final decision will be made in a year. Pocatello has become the latest city to pass an anti-discrimination ordinance in Idaho. The Pocatello City Council voted 4-2 in favor of banning discrimination due to sexual orientation or gender identity last night. The vote makes Pocatello the sixth city to ban anti-gay and transgender discrimination in Idaho. The new law makes it illegal to discriminate in areas of employment, housing, and public accommodations such as restaurants, hotels, and stores. Like most other Idaho city ordinances, the Pocatello Ordinance makes exceptions for religious organizations. The version passed last night differs from the version the Pocatello City Council failed to pass in April, which did not contain that exception. That version failed on a 3-3 vote, with Mayor Brian Blad breaking the tie. Blad, who is Mormon, faced criticism last month when it was revealed he allowed meetings between Mormon church attorney Jackie Pick and 4 out of 6 city council members and other officials. All the meetings were held on the day the council first debated the ordinance in April, and none had a quorum of city council members, meaning minutes were not taken. The meetings took place after LDS Church Public Affairs Director Larry Fisher contacted Mayor Blad to organize them. Like most of the ordinances passed in Idaho, there's a provision in the Pocatello Ordinance for a mediation process before charges are filed. The council last night amended the ordinance to include a provision that the city pay the first $250 for mediation in any such case, and the defendant would pay the next $250, and any additional mediation costs would be shared equally between the complainant and the defendant. The four Pocatello City Council members voting in favor of the ordinance last night were Roger Bray, Gary Moore, Steve Brown, and Eva Nye. Councilmember Steve Brown, who is Mormon, voted against the ordinance in April, but changed his mind because of the exception for religious organizations. The other Idaho cities with similar recently passed anti-discrimination ordinances are Boise, Sandpoint, Ketchum, Moscow, and Coeur d'Alene. In many cases, city leaders say they are passing the laws because of frustration that the Idaho legislature has, for the past seven consecutive years, declined to pass and in most cases even consider adding sexual orientation or sexual identity to the Idaho human rights law. Coeur d'Alene passed the latest anti-discrimination ordinance Tuesday. According to the Human Rights Campaign blog, over 170 cities and towns across the country have passed similar anti-discrimination ordinances. Monsanto said this week the appearance of its experimental genetically modified wheat in a field in eastern Oregon last month is an isolated incident. Monsanto officials said during a Wednesday conference call the discovery of GM wheat could have been caused by an accidental or deliberate mixing of seeds, or it could have been sabotage. Monsanto Chief Technology Officer Rob Fraley said of the sabotage possibility, "We're considering all options, and that's certainly one of the options." U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said 15 inspectors from the agency's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service are investigating, but would not speculate on the idea of sabotage. Japan has already suspended U.S. wheat imports since the discovery, and Vilsack said it's important to get world markets open to U.S. wheat quickly. The USDA said there is no evidence the GM wheat found in Oregon has entered the U.S. food supply. The South Korean government notified the USDA on Wednesday that tests so far show no GM contamination of U.S. wheat that has arrived on their shores. 90% of soft white wheat grown in Oregon, Washington, and Oregon is exported. Monsanto stopped growing outdoor experimental plots of the GM soft white wheat in 2005 because of resistance to GM foods in Europe and Asia, chief export markets. They say the last experimental plot grown in Oregon was planted in 2001. Monsanto was trying to develop a wheat variety resistant to its herbicides. The variety found in Oregon was resistant to the Monsanto-produced Roundup. Monsanto officials said during the conference call, wheat seeds are only viable for about 2 years in a harsh climate like Oregon. Monsanto Research Director Claire Kachikob said the company followed up with any entity possessing or planting the experimental seeds and confirmed they had shipped excess seeds to a USDA deep storage facility in Colorado or destroyed them. Kachikob said Monsanto also keeps some samples for testing. She said, "We've been very careful of how seed is stored and where it's stored." Washington State University entomologist Steve Shepard announced today in a press release the university is starting a honeybee sperm bank in an effort to combat colony collapse syndrome, which is decimating bee populations around the U.S. Shepard said some other problems hurting honeybee populations are pesticides, invasive mites, and limited nutritional variety of nectar because honeybees tend to work in sectors of agriculture that are monocropped. Shepard says the U.S. honeybee gene pool is limited due to 1922 restrictions on importing honeybees into the U.S. because of a tracheal mite infestation on Isle of Wight in England. The ban kept the mites out of the U.S. until 1984 and is still in effect. Shepherd said the U.S. Department of Agriculture has issued a permit to allow WSU to import honeybee semen into the country under the condition the semen is screened for viruses. Researchers at WSU are interested in breeding Italian honeybees for beekeepers in the South, and Carniolan bees from the Eastern Alps and Caucasian bees from the mountains in Georgia for colder U.S. climates because they are resistant to spring cold snaps. We'll have more on bees later in the program when we hear from Dr. Tim Hatton of Moscow on native bees, which are different from honeybees. Twin Falls County Prosecutor Grant Loebs announced today no charges will be filed against four Meridian police officers who killed a 38-year-old suicidal man. The police arrived at a home in Meridian where the mother of Eric Dilworth said her son had been threatening to kill himself. Loebs said his investigation found Dilworth did not follow commands to drop a large knife he was holding and moved quickly towards the officers, raising the knife when he was 15 or 20 feet away. All four police officers fired multiple shots. Loebs said the killing was justified. A Lemhi County Prosecutor's Office investigation has determined a 57-year-old man put in the Bonneville County Jail February 15th and who died the next day died from an overdose from an unknown drug. The office said James DeWitt of Idaho Falls died from a combination of drug toxicity and an enlarged heart. The report says it isn't known what DeWitt overdosed on, but Bonneville County Sheriff Sergeant Jeff Edwards told the Associated Press it was not one of the medicines which is distributed to inmates in the jail. DeWitt was admitted to the jail around 5 p.m. on February 15th and was found dead early the next morning. Whitman County Prosecuting Attorney Dennis Tracy gave his closing statements in the murder trial of 22-year-old Daniel Lascano today, saying the defendant spent a week searching for 23-year-old victim Daniel Schur to confront him because he and his brother believed Schur had committed burglary against them. Tracy said when the two brothers found him at a house in Malden, Daniel Lascano's brother Frank chased him out of the house. Daniel Lascano's 25-year-old brother Frank was convicted of murder in the case in March, but a jury in February was hung on the murder charge against Daniel Lascano, so a retrial was ordered. The jury in February convicted Daniel Lascano of unlawful disposal of human remains. Tracy said the jury knows based on testimony of Ben Evenson, a friend of the Lascano brothers, that Daniel Lascano was outside and yelled at Schur to stop and then shot him. Daniel Lascano had taken the stand earlier this week to say he had stayed behind at his uncle's home after changing his mind about confronting Schur because he found out his brother was driving to the Malden home of Nick Backman, and that made him nervous because of his military background and substance abuse. Lascano said he stayed behind at Uncle James Holdren's home, also in Malden, and Brother Frank and Holdren left together. Before yesterday's closing statement, Holdren testified he had nothing to do with the killing of Daniel Schur. During the closing statement, Tracy said police tapped the phone of Ben Evenson, who was at the Malden home, and he told his girlfriend over the phone when Schur's body was found in March some of the details of what he knew. He said police then confronted Evenson and he told the rest of his story. According to an account in the Daily News, Tracy told the jury, "Be careful in considering what is credible. Is it likely that after searching for Schur for a week, after driving down from Spokane and picking up his brother, that he somehow changed his mind all of a sudden?" Closing statements from the defense and rebuttal arguments were scheduled for today in Colfax. The Provo, Utah-based Vivint Incorporated plans to open a 25,000-square-foot office in Liberty Lake, hiring 400 people to design and market home automation products used for homeowner surveillance, energy management, and other purposes. Vivint said it's going through a planned expansion to increase its customer base across North America. Investigators with the National Transportation Safety Board Wednesday completed their recovery of bridge components of interest to their investigation from the Skagit River, where the Interstate 5 freeway bridge collapsed May 23rd. This clears the way for removing the remainder of the debris and completing reconstruction of the span. Washington Department of Transportation spokesperson Travis Phelps said yesterday engineers and contractors are, quote, making good progress, unquote, towards the department goal of reopening the bridge within the next 2 weeks. Residents of Winchester are facing another dry summer after the failure of a well project to provide water for the community. Last year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Development Fund gave the city $479,000 to drill two wells. One of them was dry and the other provides 30 gallons a minute from three different aquifers, which, according to Winchester City Clerk Leanne Trotman, is, quote, not viable for a community water system. The city began experiencing serious water shortages last year. Residents were prohibited from outside watering and were encouraged to curtail household water use. Trotman said the situation will be the same this year. She told the Lewiston Tribune, quote, no car washing, you can't run a sprinkler. Some people are really upset. Others are very good about even using their recycled dishwater and tub water to water their plants. The city has applied for a grant from the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality for a planning project to look at other options, which could include collecting surface water, drilling further from the city, and pumping the water in or building additional water storage capacity. Idaho State Police are still investigating a single vehicle accident on U.S. Highway 95 near the top of the Lewiston Grade, which took the life of a Moscow man yesterday afternoon. According to the Idaho State Police, a southbound 1996 Jeep Grand Cherokee driven by 68-year-old Gary D. Bishop of Moscow swerved, struck the Meridian crossing area, and became airborne. Bishop, who was not wearing a seatbelt, was ejected during the crash and pronounced dead at the scene. One dog riding in the SUV was killed, and another dog received minor injuries. A 24-year-old man was charged with felony aggravated assault and battery Wednesday after he allegedly slammed and choked his brother, punched his mother, and then threatened her with a tire jack at her home in the Syringa Mobile Home Park on Robinson Park Road east of Moscow. Police say Richard E. Cook allegedly attacked his brother and slammed his head against a trailer when the brother came to his mother's house to borrow a tire jack. All three family members reside in separate trailers at the mobile home court. Cook will appear in court on Thursday, June 20th. Cook's brother went to the Gritman Medical Center with trouble breathing, but is reportedly doing better. According to a report released yesterday by the Washington State Department of Health Statistics, same-sex marriage accounted for 20% of the marriages licensed in Washington State in the first 4 months of 2013. Washington's voter-approved same-sex marriage law took effect in early December. The report said 63% of the same-sex couples were female. About half of the marriages took place in King County, although same-sex marriages were licensed in 35 of Washington's 39 counties. Washington is one of 12 states nationwide where same-sex marriage is legally recognized. Commissioners from the Port of Clarkston authorized the port manager yesterday to enter into a $140,000 agreement with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to move forward with three dredging projects that could begin as early as this winter. One project would remove less than 10,000 cubic yards of sediment from a tour boat dock near the Quality Inn to bring the water from 10 feet deep to 14 feet deep in order to accommodate the 223-passenger cruise ship American Empress. Another project would remove sediment from the recreational boat dock near Rooster Waterfront Restaurant, where the water can be as little as 4.5 feet deep. The area would be dredged to 6.5 feet deep. That dock is used primarily by smaller motorboats, particularly water skiers. The third project would deepen the water to 16 feet in an area of an industrial dock upstream from the Red Wolf Bridge. Although that dock hasn't had any consistent business for the last 4 years, Port Manager Wander Kiefer said it's important to be prepared for new opportunities, adding, it could be years before we get to dredge again. The dockside dredging projects would piggyback on an Army Corps of Engineers project intended to remove some 400,000 cubic yards of sediment from the Snake and Clearwater River barging channel in Clarkston and Lewiston to keep the channel at least 14 feet deep. In addition to the Port of Clarkston dock projects, the Lewis-Clark Terminal is undertaking a project to dredge its loading area for grain barges in Clarkston. The dredging is being opposed by several environmental groups, and some believe it will be delayed in court. Republican U.S. Representative Raul Labrador of Idaho has withdrawn from bipartisan immigration talks because he is against providing health care coverage to undocumented people, saying when he engaged in the discussions, it was with the caveat that taxpayers would not fit the bill for medical care for undocumented people. Labrador said he will probably vote against the legislation that the coalition produces and plans to put forth his own version of the bill that comes out of discussions at the Capitol. Labrador criticized the Democratic Party for the idea that health insurance is a social responsibility of the nation, saying he believes, quote, health insurance is an individual responsibility. We now turn to our featured segment, part of a talk by Moscow entomologist and bee expert Dr. Tim Hatton, given last night at the Fisk Room of the 1912 Center in Moscow. In a presentation by the Idaho Native Plant Society and the Palouse Prairie Foundation, Hatton said if the very rare Palouse Prairie remnants are going to survive, native bees have to be present. Hatton said while native bees are not susceptible to the worldwide phenomena called colony collapse syndrome like honeybees are, they are under stress. Here's Tim Hatton.
Pollination, it's simply the act of moving pollen from the anther of a flower to the stigma of a flower. And in so doing, moving the male gametes to the female gametes, fertilizing that plant, and from that you get seeds and productivity, fruit, vegetables, or new plants. Pollinators are biotic agents, usually animals, that are involved in that process of moving pollen from the anther of a flower to the stigma of a flower and outcrossing those plants and helping those plants to be fertilized. Those are pollinators. And insects are amongst the most important of all pollinators. I show some insects here that are, let's say, some of the most common and important pollinators, starting with butterflies and moths, beetles, flies. You know, I bring up butterflies and moths because there are just some flowers out there, deep flowers with deep corollas or night blooming species in various parts of the world that are only pollinated by moths. And similarly, there are some flowers that butterflies have access to because of their long tongue. So they're very important pollinators. Most people don't think of flies too much, but flies are, they're also important pollinators. They're very frequently attracted to white flowers. I notice around here very often that flies are some of the first pollinators out, and some of the early blooming species, I see a number of flies on them. There's not a lot of data around here in terms of the importance of flies as pollinators, but I bet that they're contributing fairly significantly. And of course, there are flies that are important for the pollination of some pretty strange plants out there in the world, you know, some plants that some of them are emit odors like carrion, and they're attracted to them, and flies are the principal pollinators. So flies are important pollinators. These beetles over here are longhorn beetles, and they typically are very important pollinators because as adults they feed on pollen. So they are attracted to flowers. They do get right down into those flowers, and they eat the pollen. This is an example. This is a locust borer that will feed on the pollen of goldenrod late in the fall and then head over to its host plant, which is the black locust. And then, of course, they're like a bark beetle in that they insert their eggs into the under the bark of the trees, and they feed on the cambium, etc. But pollen is very important for them in the early stages. Honeybees are very important. I just want to get the record straight immediately by saying that I very much recognize the importance of honeybees. They're very important in agricultural systems and areas where you have intensive horticulture. They're a very efficient pollinator. And it's estimated that they contribute to at least $18 billion a year in productivity and services associated with pollination of agricultural crops. They're huge, very important. We could go on for days and days just about honeybees, but this presentation tonight is about native bees. Native bees, from just a perspective as crop pollinators, are also, in fact, very important. And as honeybee populations have been declining so rapidly over the last 5 years with pollinator collapse or with colony collapse disorder, there's more and more attention being focused on the native bees. You know, how much do they pollinate? How important are they out there? And there's more and more studies showing, in fact, that they contribute fairly significantly. A recent study estimated that they contribute at least $3 billion a year, at least, and that's just by kind of hard count. It's probably much, much greater than that. But, so here's, you know, that's all from a pragmatic perspective. If you have to justify why we care about bees, you can go to the monetary value of agricultural crops. But just step away from agricultural crops and go to native systems. All the native flora out there, all the native flora out there in the wild habitats, they're pollinated by native wild pollinators. Honeybees are in trouble. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Fortunately, we have this tremendous buffer of native wild bees out there to help us with pollination services. And while native pollinators and bees aren't vulnerable to the same specifics that honeybees are with colony collapse, they are in fact in distress. And a number of studies from Europe, which are ahead of us in looking at environmental impacts on pollinators, show, let me see if I can get this straight, three species of 25 species found in the British Isles is extinct from near as they can tell from looking at records from 1977 till now in their comparisons. Gone. They can't find them. Another eight look like their populations are really in decline and that their geographic ranges are much, much smaller than what they used to be. And here in the United States, a very recent study showed that four bumblebee species that used to be very common in the U.S. are down dramatically, down by up to 96% in terms of their relative abundances, and their geographic ranges have contracted from 23% to 87%. So that's pretty dramatic. There's only 50 species of bumblebees in the United States, so you know we're getting at about 10% there right away. So you can see there's some issues there. And when we've looked for the western bumblebee, Bombus occidentalis, on the Palouse, it hasn't been seen here since 1977. It was once a very common species. This is one of these four that's in decline. And I don't have time to go into it because it's a whole presentation discussion on itself, but it's really this reduction in their geographic range, a reduction in genetic diversity of those populations, and an introductions of pathogens that are probably reducing these bee populations. They have novel adaptations for collecting and transporting pollen and nectar because they absolutely need it for their larvae. As an example, one of the things that's important about bees is they have feathered hairs on portions of their body, whereas wasps and flies just have straight hairs. And those feathered hairs are an adaptation for pollen adhesion. The pollen sticks to those feathery hairs. And this doesn't even come close to really showing what those feathery hairs look like. They're way more feathery than this. It's a pretty neat thing to see. Bees are just more hairy in general. This is a wasp and this is a bee. And that's all part of, again, this issue of pollen adhesion. And on various parts of their body, such as for some bees, on the bottom of their abdomens or on their back legs, there are areas specific for collecting and holding pollen. They're called pollen baskets. So they have these adaptations for helping them to to store and transport pollen back to their nest. Tongues, it's really interesting. So pollen's a big part of their diet, but so is nectar. And typically they take the nectar back to their nest, and then they mix it with the pollen for their larvae. Okay. And by the way, honey is nothing but regurgitate it and evaporate it nectar. The sugar concentrations get higher and higher and higher in honey. That's what honey is. I'm just finishing by saying a larger landscape study is needed, and Paul Rhodes back there is doing one. Paul, you're sampling how many remnants? 30?
Yeah, 32.
32. That's fantastic. We only had five. He's doing 32. We're going to be getting some great information coming out. It's very cool. And with that, yeah, I just want to say, you know, what do bees need? They need stable nest sites. They need a place to nest. If it's going to get tore up, if their nests are going to get interrupted, they're not going to make it. They need floral resources throughout their cycle. When they have a nest, an active nest. And remember, they can go maybe a third of a mile, maybe a half a mile, depending on the species. That's as far as they're going to go to collect floral resources. So stable nest sites, and it can't be too terribly far from those floral resources. Protection from pesticides, and one of the big things going on is just the deterioration of these native habitats, and weeds are encroaching, and roads are destroying a bunch of the native habitats. You know, with that going on, it's going to be tough for him. But I am optimistic.
That was a portion of a talk by entomologist Tim Hatton at the 1912 Center in Moscow last night. Hatton said while working on his dissertation on ground beetles in Palouse Prairie habitat, he found almost all of the 6,000 bees in the bycatch were native bees, and there were only 12 honeybees. Of the native bees, he found there were about 100 species. Hatton said, because native bee colonies cannot be manipulated and transported by humans the way honeybee colonies are, Hatton said there's little those interested in preserving native habitat can do other than to make sure Palouse Prairie habitat is protected. KRFP citizen journalist Jill Maxwell recorded Hatton's talk for Radio Free Moscow. That's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or go to the Radio Free Moscow website, krfp.org, or radiofreemoscow.com to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. I'm Lee Robartis. Nancy Casey and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a great weekend.